and welcome to today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, April the 29th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik, and here's our first story. It's entitled Manchester Wellness Facility Gearing Up for Opening This Week. Spa to include a menu of food and drink items from Blended, a Dyersville-based healthcare cafe. It's written by Grace Neeland of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald. A new wellness facility is set to open in Delaware County with a focus on self-care as healthcare. Riverview Wellness will open Wednesday, May the 1st at 102 Legion Street in Manchester. The 7,000-square-foot facility will offer a wide variety of spa services such as massage sessions, facials, halo therapy, and more. The facility also staffs a mental health counselor and a dietitian. The idea behind it all is self-care as healthcare, the owner and aesthetician Anna Dries said. When somebody walks in the door, we want to be treating the whole person, not just one part of them. Riverview Wellness brings multiple independent providers under one roof, Dries explained. That allows providers across the different modalities to collaborate and help clients approach wellness in a holistic manner. The spa will offer one-on-one services and group classes, and the space also will include a menu of food and drink items from Blended, a Dyersville-based health cafe. The team that has come together here really is an absolute A-team, said operations manager Amy Whitman. In such a busy world, we're all here to make this a place where people can find some peace and tranquility. Dries said she hopes to curate an atmosphere of comfort and care at the spa, adding that the space has a strict no-judgment policy that allows people to come in and center their own well-being. She added that she is especially excited to offer the atmosphere and those services in a rural area like Manchester. Currently, she said, people need to drive an hour or more for many of the services Riverview soon will offer right in town. In rural areas, we don't always get the same experiences as people living in bigger cities without having to travel, Dries said. I'm really excited to offer this here locally to people so people can get that experience closer to home. Riverview Wellness will be open 9 a.m. to 7 p.m. Monday through Friday with select weekend hours. Additional information about the business can be found online at riverview-wellness.com. Next up is an article entitled, Iowa Lawmakers Target Crime Punishment. New statutes on online harassment include one that criminalizes distributing digitally altered, often AI-generated, images of people. It's written by Benjamin Fisher of the Telegraph Herald. Beyond taxes and education spending, the Iowa legislature passed numerous laws creating new crimes, increasing penalties for others, which were not listed as priorities before the session's start. While they were not as high profile as some education and state government bills during the session, these changes to Iowa's criminal code and regulatory structure together made up the majority of the 151 bills the legislature passed this year. Judiciary bills did make waves during session included criminalizing being an undocumented migrant in the state and authorizing state law enforcement to deport undocumented people they find in Iowa and creating immunity for people acting based on their religious belief. Iowa Senator Chris Cornoyer, a Republican from LeClaire, celebrated the controversial illegal immigration law and other increased criminal punishments after the session. Taking matters into our own hands, after the failures of the federal government, we passed Senate File 2340, making being an illegal alien in Iowa a state crime. We also raised the penalties for those who make fake reports to law enforcement officers, increased retirement benefits for sheriffs and deputies, and made looting a crime in Iowa. Iowa House Minority Whip Lindsey James, a Democrat from Dubuque, serves on the House Judiciary Committee and said the illegal immigration bill reflected flawed priorities of the Iowa Republicans more broadly. The unfortunate reality is that Washington, D.C. politics are seeping into our state, she said. The fact that Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds continues to send our troopers to the border and say every state is a border state and demonize people who have come here looking for a better life found its way into our lawmaking this year. The Judiciary Committee, you see a lot of partisan culture war bills go through, and that does no one any good. Kornoyer also used her position as chair of the Senate Technology Committee to run bills creating new crimes for online harassments. One new law expanded the state's sexual harassment code to include creating and distributing digital material that shows someone nude and or engaged in sexual acts, including material that has been altered to falsely depict those acts, a top priority of Kornoyer's since she heard of such altered material being made of a high school student, she told the TEH at the state capitol this session. Along those lines, the legislature also passed bills to criminalize generating and distributing digitally altered, often AI-generated images of people, which Iowa Representative Shannon Lundgren, a Republican from Piasta, said was particularly important in an election year. The digital likenesses issue was a big one, she said. People can take a picture of you now and make you walk and talk and say whatever they want. Here in Iowa, it's not like the Democratic Party are going to do that to Iowa Republicans or vice versa, but you could get big national PACs who would do that here. The legislature also increased punishments for several controlled substances for assaults by a person violating a protective order, robbery, trespassing, tampering with witnesses or jurors, bestiality, human trafficking, nuisances at adult cabarets or strip clubs. The legislature also created the crimes of organized retail theft and looting, a Republican talking point this election cycle, highlighting cases in big Democrat-led cities. Iowa Senate Minority Leader Pam Yoakum, a Democrat from Dubuque, said some silver lining of a session she generally portrayed as negative came in the final few days by way of a law to temporarily expand the statute of limitations for people who had been sexually molested in their youth while Boy Scouts, qualifying more of them for a national settlement. At least we changed the civil statute of limitations that will allow adults who were sexually abused as kids to recover the full amount of money, she said. We had to change the law to make them whole, but the Republicans also made sure that law expires or is repealed by January 1st of 2026. It's something we should have made permanent, but they chose to make it a one-time thing. Yoakum regretted the fact that none of the increases in regulations pushed by the Republican majority included environmental protections, particularly criticizing a law that bars local governments for regulating stormwater runoff at construction sites beyond state and federal levels. Neither Iowa Republican Chuck Eisenhardt, a Democrat for Dubuque, nor Iowa Senator Kerry Colker, a Republican from Dyersville, responded to requests for comment for this story. Our final story from the front page of the Telegraph Herald today falls under the Love That Lasts series, and it's entitled Being Right Partner, Important Part of Dubuque Couple's 54 Years Together. Gary and Jane Schuster were married April 25, 1970 at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Ryan, and this is written by Michelle London of the Telegraph Herald. They didn't know it at the time, but Gary Schuster and Jane McElliott were only one degree of separation away from each other nearly their entire lives, thanks to Gary's cousin. In 1967, Gary, who had grown up in New Vienna and Dyersville, Iowa, was an 18-year-old Navy aviation mechanic stationed in Florida who was home on emergency leave when his father got sick and passed away. As sad as the visit home was, he did take time to attend his cousin Janice Evers' graduation party. 16-year-old Jane lived in Ryan, Iowa, and was excited to attend her lifelong best friend Janice's graduation celebration. When she spotted Gary, she immediately asked Janice's dad who he was. He had been in Florida, and he was very toned and very brown, the now Jane Schuster, age 73, said. He had beautiful blue eyes and a wonderful smile, and I was just drawn to that smile. I thought, who is that? Jane didn't know it then, but Gary had asked his uncle about Jane. She got out of the car, and just the way she looked when she smiled, Gary, now age 75, said. We just started talking, and she was easy to talk to. The pair made an instant connection at that party, but Gary was going to have to go back to Florida in 3 days, and then he was shipping out to Vietnam, so they made the most of the time they had. He picked me up from work, and then we did something kids today probably don't understand, Jane said. We drove around, and we talked. He said to me, "Will you write to me?" And I said I would. Then that Sunday, he went to church with me, and to me, that was pretty impressive. Jane attended nursing school and began working at Mercy Hospital in Dubuque. Gary served on the aircraft carrier USS Constellation, which patrolled waters off both North and South Vietnam. He would also serve on the USS Forrestal, a supercarrier that deployed to the Mediterranean during Gary's time on it. When Gary was back stateside in the summer of 1969, he and Jane arranged to meet in Georgia so they could see each other again. "One of my good friends lived in Atlanta," he said, "so she flew in and we stayed there, and we got engaged over that weekend. Over a spaghetti dinner," Jane added, "he got down on his knee and everything." Gary's service in the Navy was completed soon after that, and they began planning their wedding. The couple married on April the 25th, 1970, at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Ryan. They recently celebrated their 54th anniversary. After a Niagara Falls, New York honeymoon, they settled in Dubuque in an apartment on Hill Street. Eventually, they moved to a home on Theda Street, where they raised their three children, Tony, Amy, Schubert, and Nick. They also have seven grandchildren, with one more on the way. Nick of Omaha, Nebraska, remembers a family where faith was paramount. "That was probably the center point of our family and of my parents' relationship," he said. "They both worked, but every Sunday came, come rain, shine, snow, whatever, we went to church. Even on family vacations, they would find a local church to attend Sunday Mass. No matter where we were, we'd always look for a church," Jane said. After working a few different jobs, Gary trained as an insurance agent for Farmers Insurance. He eventually opened his own agency, which he has operated for 54 years so far. Jane had a 48-year career as a nurse at Mercy Hospital, spending most of it in the NICU. She also became a board-certified lactation consultant and began with fellow nurse Kathy Murphy, the first lactation program at Mercy. She retired in 2016. "But then, in 2018, I began as a nursing tutor," she said. For the past 6 years, Jane has worked a few days a week tutoring students at Northeast Iowa Community College in Piasta, Iowa. Gary also coaches girls basketball at Wallert High School and has been a softball coach as well. The couple is very involved at St. Anthony's Catholic Church, particularly with Marriage Encounter and a faith-sharing group with several other couples. "They're both really active in service," Nick said. "They've been rectors and chaplains and every other position in the church, and those groups they're involved in aren't just about religion. Those people have become close friends that they often socialize with." 16 years ago, Gary and Jane sold their home on Theda Street, where they lived for over 30 years. While most people are downsizing to smaller homes later in life, the Schusters upsized so there would be room for children and grandchildren to visit and spread out. "The kids are gone. They've got grandkids now," Nick said. "I think they're kind of like, we did the blood, sweat, and tears part. Now we're going to reap the reward and enjoy those results." Nick will be accompanying Gary next month to an honor flight in Washington, D.C. It's something he and his father are looking forward to. "We're excited about that," he said. "It's just another example of how my dad has served." Gary and Jane have also spent their marriage serving each other. "Sometimes we're kind to other people, but the person we're closest to gets the leftovers," Jane said. "We make each other a priority. He gets up and brings me a cup of coffee every morning, and he doesn't even drink coffee." As an adult, Nick said he is fascinated by how his parents' relationship has changed through the years. "The big one for me is their unconditional love," he said. "It's been really interesting to see it from the adult side now and see how their dynamic has changed over the years. And they get it. I don't know how they figured it out, but they did. They're together because they want to be. Surrounding their marriage with positive people has been one of the keys to their success. I think being close to people who are committed and who are good people is important in a marriage," Jane said. "Socializing with people who have the same values and life beliefs just enriches and strengthens you." Gary said he thinks it's important that people considering marriage shouldn't be looking just at their future spouse, but should look within themselves. "It's not just about marrying the right partner," he said. "It's also about being the right partner." The top story on the Dubuque and Tri-State page is entitled "Festival's Local Film Block Displays a Lot of Creativity. Directors with Area Ties Enjoy a Chance to Shine." This is written by Eric Hugstrom. Benjamin Schmidt described the past week as a validating experience. Schmidt of Bellevue, Iowa, has been attending the Julian Dubuque International Film Festival for 10 years, originally to watch films and learn about filmmaking. This year, one of his films was included at the annual festival as part of a Made in Iowa block of short movies showcasing local filmmakers. "I've been coming to the festival to meet the filmmakers," Schmidt said. "Now I'm one of them, and it feels really strange." Schmidt directed Inheritance, one of six short films shown at Five Flags Theater on Sunday, the final day of the five-day festival. "This is my sixth short film, and I am currently in post-production for my first feature film, but this is my first time here at the festival as a filmmaker," Schmidt said. "It's been a great week. There's something about being here with a film and seeing filmmakers get as excited about it as I am excited about their work." Jacob Schemmel of Dubuque directed his short film, The History of Broadcasting, as part of a class project at Clark University. "I thought this was just going to be a film for the class, and then it turned into this whole big thing," Schemmel said of the film's inclusion at the festival. "It's crazy." Jen Hoag of East Dubuque, Illinois, co-directed the short film, A Swan's Song, with Rob Underhill of Raleigh, North Carolina. Hoag said the local film scene continues to grow. "We have a lot of creativity here. That's evident in that we have an Iowa film block this year," Hoag said. "There's just so much energy around here, people being so supportive of each other." The homegrown nature of the films drew block attendees like Beth Stadel of Hazel Green, Wisconsin. "It's exciting to see local people have an opportunity to show their films here," she said. Paul Kretzides of Dubuque directed the short film In Your Head. He described having his filmmaking team's short included in the Iowa block of films as a magical experience. "We put a lot of blood, sweat, and tears into this project for a little over 4 months," Kurtzides said. "To see it come to fruition with all of these other films doing Iowa premieres is an interesting energy. It's fun." Kurtzides said the festival's gathering of filmmakers and filmgoers feels like the celebrations associated with a wedding. "You get to meet people from L.A., the East Coast, and around the world," he said. "It's a nice experience to have in the key city." Kurtzides said aspiring filmmakers should find inspiration in the films showcased during the Iowa block. "If you have a good idea, pitch it to everyone," he said. "Once you write the script, once you find the actors, once you find the set, once you get everything moving in motion, just keep doing it. Make your film and get it out there. The more you do it, the better you will get at it." Now some short articles from under the news in brief heading. First, State Patrol identifies driver killed in Delaware County UTV crash. Dateline is Ryan, Iowa. A Manchester man was killed in a two-vehicle crash involving a utility vehicle in rural Delaware County. Kyle J. Kelchin, age 39, of Manchester, was killed in the crash, according to a report from the Iowa State Patrol. The report states that Kelchin was operating a UTV on South 190th Avenue in rural Ryan at about 2:15 p.m. Friday when he failed to stop at a stop sign and his UTV was struck by a pickup truck traveling east on 310th Street. Both vehicles came to rest in the ditch. The driver of the pickup, Gerald J. Bites, age 67, passenger Susan E. Bites, age 65, both of Monticello, Iowa, were injured, but they were not transported to a hospital, according to the report. The crash remains under investigation by the Iowa State Patrol. Next, Platteville City Swap slated. Dateline is Platteville, Wisconsin. An upcoming event will give Platteville residents an opportunity to exchange gently used items. Platteville City Swap will be held May 18th at Flaherty, Inc., 1120 Broadway Street, according to an online announcement. Items may be dropped off at the site from 8 a.m. to noon. Volunteers will help sort through loads of items to determine whether items can be swapped, recycled, or taken to the landfill. Participants may pick up the unwanted items of others for reuse from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. Items remaining at the end of the day will be donated to local thrift stores or disposed of properly. A special fee will be required to recycle appliances, electronics, tires, and lithium-ion and lead-acid batteries. Owner of two businesses to speak, Dateline Bellevue, Iowa, The owner of two businesses will be featured during a free discussion in Bellevue about entrepreneurship. Peyton Marshall will be spotlighted in Wednesdays Are Possible, an event held at 4:30 p.m. Wednesday, May the 1st at Prost Pub, 101 South 2nd Street, Bellevue, according to a press release. Wednesdays Are Possible are held jointly by Jackson County Economic Alliance and Innovate 120, an entrepreneurship hub and co-working space in Maquoketa with funding from Community Foundation of Jackson County. Marshall is owner of Prost Pub and Surge IT. And Music School to hold free concert. Northeast Iowa School of Music will hold a free concert by its adult music ensembles this week. The concert will occur at 7 p.m. Tuesday, April the 30th at Westminster Presbyterian Church, 2155 University Avenue, according to an online announcement. The event includes performances by New Horizons Band, Heartland Harmony, and the Dubuque Community String Orchestra. Here's an article from the Lifestyle Health page. Ozempic Oops Babies. A spate of pregnancies from women on weight loss drugs sparks debate about the use of the drugs to help fertility. It's written by Madison Muller of the Bloomberg News. A surprising thing is happening to some women on weight loss drugs who've struggled with fertility issues. They're getting pregnant. That's leading to questions about the safety of medications from Novo Nordisk AS and Eli Lilly and Company during pregnancy. I thought I couldn't have any more kids, said Toria Leggett, age 40, who had been trying for another after her first child was born in 2018. In 2022, the social worker from Whiteville, North Carolina, began taking Novo's Ozempic to treat obesity, then switched to Lilly's Mounjaro. As the pounds melted off, there was soon another reason to celebrate. She was expecting. The weight loss, that's likely what jump-started it, she said. I couldn't believe it. Stories like these are encouraging doctors to use GLP-1 drugs to treat polycystic ovary syndrome, one of the leading causes of infertility in U.S. women. Yet they're doing so without much data on the drug's impact on pregnancy. The oops babies on Ozempic and Wegovy are happening all over the place, said Melanie Cree, director of the PCOS clinic at Children's Hospital Colorado in Aurora. It's very exciting, but it's a bit scary because we're moving forward without all the data. The need for treatments is severe. Despite its prevalence, no drugs are approved for PCOS, and experts are divided on whether commonly recommended diet programs work. Some doctors and patients are willing to try almost anything, and the successes are tantalizing. GLP-1 drugs have been marketed for nearly 20 years to treat diabetes, and their use in obesity is fueling a new market that's expected to hit $100 billion in 2030. The problem is companies haven't systematically studied GLP-1's use in PCOS and don't plan to anytime soon. In the absence of data, researchers are doing studies of their own to figure out if the drugs work for PCOS, and U.S. regulators have asked the companies to collect any information they can about their use during pregnancy. So far, the safety data look promising. A recent study of the health records of 50,000 women with type 2 diabetes found no increase in birth defects among those who used the drugs in very early pregnancy compared with those who took insulin. Still, the study's authors said additional confirmation is needed, especially in women without diabetes. Researchers from Copenhagen concluded last year in a review of GLP-1 drugs, saying that there's limited information on their long-term safety, particularly concerning pregnancy outcomes. Reasons for concern come mostly from animal experiments. The active ingredient in Novo's drug, semaglutide, has been linked to increased birth defects in animals. Similar studies of Lilly's drugs have showed there may be risks to the fetus from exposure during pregnancy, the company said. No one is exactly sure how or even whether the drugs contribute to women becoming pregnant. Weight loss is known to boost fertility in women with PCOS, and studies have shown that Saxenda, an older obesity drug, also raised pregnancy rates in women with the disorder who were overweight. GLP-1s may also have hormonal effects that promote fertility and may blunt the impact of oral contraceptives. Some experts think the drugs might even have a role in male infertility. Rekha Kumar, a reproductive endocrinologist at Weill Cornell Medicine, says GLP-1 drugs wake up the ovaries, resetting the reproductive environment for normal function. After treating patients with infertility and obesity for more than 15 years, one thing is clear, Kumar said, these patients are becoming very fertile. Pregnant people and those planning to get pregnant were excluded from trials of GLP-1s. Trial participants have been required to use contraception, and treatment was discontinued for those who became pregnant during the clinical trials of Mounjaro and Zepbound, Lilly said. Experts are split on how soon patients should stop taking the medications before a planned pregnancy. Some doctors are telling patients that up to 4 weeks is safe. Others say it's fine to keep using them up until the time of pregnancy. Wegovy's label says people should stop taking the drug at least 2 months before trying to get pregnant, while Zepbound recommends that people who become pregnant stop the drug. In Colorado, Cree is running a study to find out how Novo's Wegovy affects ovulation in women with PCOS, but ongoing supply problems with the popular drug present a challenge. Novo won't provide free supplies because the patients won't be on birth control, she said, a decision she called very disappointing. Meanwhile, a study found that the number of women exposed to GLP-1 drugs during early pregnancy appears to be increasing as more turn to them for diabetes and other conditions. The Facebook group I Got Pregnant on Ozempic has 597 members. On TikTok, dozens have said they've become pregnant while taking a GLP-1 drug. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration asked Novo to set up a registry to collect data on those who got pregnant while taking Wegovy, but the company has yet to share any results. It's also required to do an additional pregnancy study using insurance claims or electronic medical records, the FDA said. Lilly is planning to set up a similar registry, but declined to say when. Meanwhile, Cree and a handful of researchers are scrambling to set up their own databases to track pregnancy outcomes in GLP-1 patients. PCOS is a somewhat mysterious condition that typically involves irregular ovulation and high levels of male hormones called androgens. It's the most common hormonal disorder in women, putting them at increased risk of diabetes, heart disease, and mental health issues. Those with the condition frequently make too much testosterone, leading to effects like extra hair growth, acne, and weight gain, and blocking ovulation. They also don't respond properly to insulin, and the weight loss effects of GLP-1s may improve sensitivity to the hormone. The new drugs are not going to cure you, but it's going to improve the symptoms significantly, said Ricardo Aziz, a PCOS expert and professor at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and SUNY Albany in New York. Still, he thinks more data is needed before doctors recommend the drugs for fertility. People like Leggett, who got pregnant on a weight loss drug, also have some questions. She sometimes wonders why her daughter is smaller than other kids the same age. She's teeny tiny, Leggett said. I'd like to know more about that. Now move over to the opinion page and read an other view entitled Civics Literacy Crucial Amid Fragility of Our Democratic System. It's written by Mary Smith, who is president of the American Bar Association. A survey from the American Bar Association shows that most Americans are pessimistic about our nation's democracy and are worried about the upcoming election. It's another reminder of the fragility of our democratic system at this perilous time in our nation's history. These results are revealed in the annual 2024 ABA Survey of Civic Literacy, released as part of the ABA's celebration of Law Day, which has been observed since 1958. The survey was implemented 5 years ago and is designed to gauge people's knowledge of how government works and seek their opinions about timely topics concerning government. This year, we asked a series of questions on the state of democracy in the United States. The results are sobering. 74% of respondents believe our democracy is weaker than it was 5 years ago. When respondents were asked what they think is the primary cause of this weakened democracy, nearly a third said the biggest problem is disinformation and misinformation, and almost another third blamed political parties. Election integrity is also a significant concern. Please make no mistake, Americans value their elections. The survey asked, what do you think is the most important part of a democratic government? Half said free and fair elections. Nothing else came close. However, the public's belief in the importance of elections as fundamental to democracy is undercut by fears regarding the next election. Most respondents reported they were worried about the integrity of the November election. More than a third said their primary concern is that there will be election subversion, that is, meddling with the vote counting process. An additional 21% said voter suppression, discouraging or preventing specific groups of people from voting, is their biggest concern. Less than a quarter said their biggest concern is voter fraud, people voting more than once, or ineligible people voting. The results also revealed that the public recognizes the vital connection between the protection of democracy and civics literacy. When asked who should be primarily responsible for safeguarding our democracy, the most popular response was the general public, cited by 37%. Ironically, respondents held a dim view of the public's knowledge of the topic. Nearly two-thirds reported that the public was not very informed or not at all informed about how democracy works. This key takeaway from the survey demonstrates that we have a lot of work ahead to repair the public's fears about democracy and election integrity. The survey suggests an important place to start is to increase civics literacy. Repairing American democracy has been a central focus of my ABA presidency. Last August, we created the nonpartisan ABA Task Force for American Democracy, which is examining ways to ensure the survival of our nation's democracy. Through the important work of the task force, we are focusing on restoring public confidence in the American election system, a system that, notwithstanding efforts to undermine its integrity, has been proven time and again to be safe and secure. Through the work of the advisory commission to the task force, we are partnering with bar associations nationwide to develop programming that addresses the legal profession's special responsibility to fight for democracy and the rule of law. The ABA is stepping up because lawyers must engage in the cause of our lifetime. This survey reveals worrisome fractures in the public's perceptions of our democracy and is consistent with other vital data on this topic. Americans have grave doubts about the future of many freedoms we have spent centuries fighting to achieve. As the country's largest voluntary organization of lawyers, the ABA plans to lead on this issue until our democracy is secured. We ask all lawyers nationwide to join us as leaders in our communities and states. Every one of us took an oath to uphold the rule of law. Now is the time to ensure we are living up to that promise. And again, this was written by Mary Smith, who is president of the American Bar Association. You're listening to the Dubuque Telegraph Herald on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. All material heard on IRIS is intended solely for the use of the blind and print disabled. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. If you have any comments on this or any other IRIS program, please give us a call at area code 515-243-6833. Now we'll turn to today's obituaries. We remember Greg Sigrand, age 74, of Dubuque, who died on Sunday, April the 28th. Visitation will be held from 9 to 10:45 a.m. on Thursday, May the 2nd, at Hoffman, Schneider & Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road, where a prayer service will follow at 11 a.m. Entombment will take place in Mount Calvary Cemetery. We have some pendings. First, Janine E. Anderson of Preston, Iowa, visitation 1 to 3 p.m. today at St. John's Lutheran Church in Preston. Service 3 p.m. today at the church. Celebration of life at 4:30 p.m. today in Preston Town Hall. Barbara J. Burroughs of Galena, Illinois, visitation from 9:30 to 11 a.m. Saturday, May the 4th at Miller Funeral Home, East Dubuque. Memorial service 11 a.m. Saturday at the funeral home. William Folger of Dubuque, visitation 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Monday, June 17th, Hoffman, Schneider & Kitchen Funeral Home and Crematory, 3860 Asbury Road. David J. Gogel, G-O-G-E-L, of Dyersville, Iowa, visitation 4 to 8 p.m. Tuesday, April 30th at Rife Funeral Home in Dyersville. service 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, May the 1st at St. Francis Xavier Basilica of Dyersville. Clayton Gabe Griebel, G-R-I-E-B-E-L, of Maquoketa, Iowa. Visitation 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. Tuesday, April the 30th at First Lutheran Church in Maquoketa. Services from is at 2 p.m. Tuesday at the church. Ryan P. Kenkel, Platteville, Wisconsin. Visitation 10 a.m. to noon today at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Platteville. William Mitchell of Stockton, Illinois. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Friday, May the 3rd at Herman Funeral Home in Stockton. Service at 11 a.m. Saturday, May the 4th at Calvary United Methodist Church in Stockton. Inez D. Nutt of Madison, Wisconsin. Oh, there'll be a wake service at 3:45 p.m. on Tuesday, April the 30th at Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday at the funeral home and from 8:30 to 10 a.m. Wednesday, May the 1st, Sacred Heart Catholic Church. Mass of Christian Burial, 10 a.m. Wednesday at the church. Wilbert E. Post of Petoskey, Wisconsin. Visitation 9 to 11 a.m. Tuesday, April the 30th at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home and Crematory in Potosi. Services will take place at 11 a.m. Tuesday at the funeral home. David A. Ryder of Asbury, Iowa. Visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. today at Egelhoff, Siegert, and Casper Funeral Home and Crematory, 2659 John F. Kennedy Road. Service will be held at 11 a.m. today at the funeral home. Ronald B. Sarazen of Dubuque. Visitation 4 to 7 p.m. today, Leonard Funeral Home and Crematory, 2595 Rockdale Road. Services will be at 7 p.m. today at the funeral home. Leola A. Scaife, S-K-A-I-F-E, of Preston, Iowa. Celebration of Life will take place 9 to 11 a.m. Saturday, May the 4th, at Martin Schwartz Funeral Home in Lancaster, Wisconsin. And Elaine A. Taylor of Sinsinawa, Wisconsin. Service at 10 a.m. Tuesday, April the 30th, at St. Dominic Villa in Sinsinawa. Another health article is entitled, Heart Disease Stroke Risk May Be Higher in Certain Neighborhoods. People living in neighborhoods with high rates of environmental and socioeconomic problems may face a higher risk for heart disease and double the risk for stroke, new research finds. The study, published in the Journal of the American Heart Association, found the combination of chronic environmental and social issues, including higher rates of pollution and unemployment, contributed to widening disparities in cardiovascular health, and that environmental factors alone played a significant role. Our study is one of the first to examine the impact of both social and environmental factors in combination and looked at the complex interplay between them, senior author Dr. Sarju Ganatra said in a news release. Ganatra, a cardiologist, is vice chair of the Department of Medicine for Research and director of the Cardio-Oncology Program and South Asian Cardio-Metabolic Program at Lehigh Hospital and Medical Center in Burlington, Massachusetts. Recent studies have shown neighborhoods with greater social and environmental disadvantages have higher rates of cardiovascular disease and its risk factors. In this new study, researchers wanted to explore how much of a role environmental factors played both independently and in combination with socioeconomic factors. For the study, environmental disadvantages included air and water pollution, the presence of potentially hazardous or toxic sites, few recreational parks and heavy road traffic, along with the presence of railways or airports. Social factors included racial and ethnic minority status, income, education, and employment levels, housing status, and access to the internet and healthcare. The analysis showed that residents of the most environmentally and socially vulnerable neighborhoods at 1.68 times the rate of coronary heart disease and more than twice the rate of stroke compared to people in the least vulnerable neighborhoods. People in the most vulnerable neighborhoods also had higher rates of type 2 diabetes, chronic kidney disease, high blood pressure, and obesity. I was amazed to see the tight links and complex interplay between social and environmental factors on health outcomes, Ganatra said. We were able to demonstrate their dual hit on health outcomes. And beyond that, we were more amazed by the fact that even after adjusting for socioeconomic factors, environmental factors played a crucial and independent role in determining various heart disease and other related health outcomes. People living in the most environmentally and socially vulnerable neighborhoods had the highest percentage of Black and Hispanic adults, while the least vulnerable neighborhoods had the lowest percentage of racial and ethnic minorities. The researchers, Ganatra said, believe reversing the impact of environmental and socioeconomic disadvantage will require a multi-pronged approach that includes reducing exposure to air pollution and establishing policies to address poverty, urban revitalization, public education, job creation, and affordable housing, as well as increased access to quality health care. Our aim is to empower the health care community to better inform patients about environmental factors they encounter daily, he said. Patients, in turn, gain the ability to reduce their exposure to harmful environmental conditions, such as exposure to harmful chemicals and air pollutants, to minimize health hazards and mitigate health risks. Now it's time to turn over to the sports page, and we'll take a brief look at what's on TV in the sports world today. First, in Major League Baseball, we've got the Cardinals at the Tigers at 5:40 p.m. on Bally Sports Midwest. The Cubs are at the Mets at 6:10 p.m. on Marquee Sports Network. And the Twins are at the White Sox at 6:40 p.m. on FS1 and on NBC Sports Chicago. The Rays are at the Brewers at 6:40 p.m. on Bally Sports Wisconsin. In the National Hockey League, we've got the Lightning at the Panthers at 6 p.m. on ESPN and the Stars at the Golden Knights at 8:30 p.m. on ESPN. And in the National Basketball League, we've got Celtics at Heat, 6:30 p.m. on TNT and True TV. And then at 9 p.m., we've got the Lakers at the Nuggets on TNT or True TV. Top story on the sports page is entitled Clark Turning Focus Back to Basketball. Former Iowa star excited to begin with Indiana. It's written by Michael Merritt. Caitlin Clark got back to the basics Sunday, working out on a basketball court. Here, as the newest member of the Indiana Fever, she's learning how she'll fit into this new offensive system, building chemistry with her new teammates, and learning the nuances of what it means to be the WNBA's highest-profile rookie. Sure, Clark anticipates some bumps this season. She wouldn't expect anything less. But giving the sport she loves her full attention is really all Clark ever wanted. I think that's what I was most excited for, getting all that other stuff out of the way, the former Iowa star said as Indiana's training camp opened. The draft was amazing, New York City was amazing, Los Angeles was amazing, but I was excited to get here and get back to playing basketball, you know, doing my job. Over the past two seasons, these WNBA rookies have created the kind of buzz around women's basketball most fans only dreamed of, and Clark is certainly at the head of the class. Ticket sales increased at every venue she appeared, and when Clark's games were televised, ratings spiked. Her chase to the Division I career scoring record captivated basketball fans across America, and she even appeared on Saturday Night Live. Perhaps even more fittingly, the transition from the established stars to newcomers, such as Clark, officially started the same day another trailblazing performer, Candace Parker, announced her retirement. But, like Parker, Clark enters the season with one primary goal, winning games. I think no matter what happens, there's going to be expectations and pressure on my shoulders and pressure on this team to be really good. That's how you want it. Clark said, we wouldn't want anything else. We want people showing up to our games, people expecting us to win a lot of basketball games this year, and I'm expecting myself to play really well. I don't think it's anything that's ever been different for me. Indiana hasn't reached the playoffs since 2016, hasn't posted a winning season since 2015, and has been mostly irrelevant nationally since Hall of Famer Tamika Catchings retired. Over the past five seasons, the Fever won 28 games. Iowa, meanwhile, went 65-12 and with two national runner-up finishes in the last two seasons. But the pairing of Clark and Aaliyah Boston, the WNBA's unanimous Rookie of the Year last season, has turned Indiana into one of the league's hottest tickets. Several opponents already have moved games to larger arenas, and Boston, for one, is eager to see how quickly Indiana's new lineup will mesh. Clark arrived in town early this past week and has been turning heads with her workouts ever since. I think Caitlin has a different eye for the game. You're able to see how well she passes the ball and how well she shoots it, Boston said. You see her communicating. You see the way she can find you. I mean, her passes are tremendous. I'm like, okay, I'll get a touch. Just get me down there, just because of how well she passes it. Next is an article entitled Overtime Jubilation. Jubinville scores at 4:48 into extra session to lift Saints in Game 1, written by Jim Leitner. Jaden Jubinville saw his opportunity to jump into the play, and it resulted in the biggest goal of his career. The defenseman from Gilbert Plains, Manitoba, scored 4 minutes and 48 seconds into overtime to lift the Dubuque Fighting Saints to a 4-3 victory over Muskegon in Game 1 of the USHL's Eastern Conference Final at I'm On Arena. Dubuque, which squandered a 2-goal lead in the third period, hosts Game 2 in the best-of-five series at 7 p.m. tonight. I don't think I've ever scored a bigger goal, at least that I remember, Jubinville said. Hopefully, there's even bigger goals coming for our team. It's obviously nice to get Game 1, but for the next couple of games, we're going to have to find a way to close out games better than we did tonight. We're just going to continue to keep doing what we're doing well. On the winning goal, Seamus Powell broke the puck out of his own zone to James Reeder, who helped it along to Noah Powell in the neutral zone for a touch pass to Jake Sondrial. The captain carried into the Muskegon zone on the right wing, fell, and made a pass to Jubinville from his knees. Jubinville kicked the puck to his tape after Muskegon's Jake Toll got a stick on it, then sidestepped Cody Kroll before taking a shot from the low slot that handcuffed goalie Godziv. Sonny made a hell of a play to get it to me. I saw there was a lane to the net. I took it there and found a way to get it into the back of the net, Jubinville said. Maybe it was a little lucky, but I'll take it. Jubinville scored his second goal of the playoffs and second game winner in 58 combined games this season. He's a playoff warrior, Saints coach Kirk McDonald said. He's obviously not a big offensive guy, but he has good instincts. He was solid all season long. But you win this time of year with guys like that who step up in the moment like that one. Muskegon clawed back from a 3-1 deficit on goals by Kroll at the 6:11 mark of the third period and Jack Galanek just 6 minutes and 19 seconds later. The Lumberjacks outshot the Saints 14-5 in the third period. They got a couple of good bounces, and that's playoff hockey, McDaniel said. I had to settle myself down first. But whether we come back from 2 down or blow a 3-1 lead or we're trading goals, there's nothing you can do about that in overtime. I thought we played 50 minutes of really good hockey, but we found a way to win, and that's all that matters at this time of year. After a scoreless first period, Gavin Conforth staked the Saints a 1-0 lead at 3 minutes 26 seconds of the second period. Fisher Scott absorbed a hit in his own end, and Charlie Arend pushed the puck forward to spring Cornforth for a 2-on-1 with Michael Barron. Cornforth snapped his first playoff goal inside the left post. That was huge, Cornforth said. We had a few ugly shots before that, but after that goal, the momentum shifted and the team turned it on after that. I felt really good to score because I haven't had one in a little bit. It was nice to see it go in, and the crowd was great tonight. Scott doubled the lead at 5 minutes 42 seconds with his first of the playoffs. He started the play by keeping the puck in the Muskegon zone at the blue line and moved it to Beckett Hendrickson, who returned it as Scott pinched in front from point. Scott then fed Eric Paulsen and scored on the rebound of Paulsen's shot. Obviously, it was 0-0 for a while there, so it was fun to watch Corny get on the board. Adding on to it was good for our momentum, Scott said. We stuck with it, and luckily we came out with the win. In any league, it's so important to have scoring depth. The teams that win the Stanley Cup every year have a lot of contributions from top to bottom. Our guys are putting in the work and are getting rewarded for it. After Ty Hendricks scored at 9 minutes and 4 seconds of the second to end Kevin Riedler's shutout bid, Teddy Merrill became the 11th different Saints player to score a goal 3 minutes and 26 seconds later. Matthew Desidero won a battle in his own zone to chip the puck to Andrew King in the neutral zone. King, celebrating his 21st birthday, moved the puck to Merrill for a 2-on-1 with Colin Frank, and Merrill rifled a shot inside the left post for his first playoff goal. It's big to win the first one, especially since Muskegon hasn't had a lot of rest after going 5 games in the last round, Merrill said. We just have to keep building off of this, even though we know they're going to come out hard tonight. In men's college volleyball, Kingsmen wear crown. California Lutheran sweeps Vassar to claim NCAA championship at Loras. It's written by Jim Leitner. Michael Stahl delivered an All-American performance in the biggest match in the 9-year history of the California Lutheran University as an NCAA Division III program. The 6'5" senior outside hitter floored 23 kills and made just 2 errors on 40 swings for a .525 attack percentage to lead the Kingsmen to a 25-22, 25-23, 25-23 victory over Vassar College in the national championship match at Loras College's Lillis Court. Cal Lutheran, which made its NCAA tournament debut this spring, won all 4 of its matches at Loras to claim the title in the 16-team tournament. I was able to see the court really well today, but it all goes back to my teammates, said Stahl, who finished with 46 kills in 2 Final Four matches en route to being named the most valuable player of the tournament. They make me successful with their play. Taylor Marks put up 43 assists as the floor general for the Kingsmen. Jordan Cooper and Ben Weber added 7 kills apiece, while Boris Horik added 5 and Parker Brown 3. As a team, Cal Lutheran hit a .366 clip, while Vassar swung at a .260 percentage. I looked over at Coach, and he kept telling me to feed the hot hand, Taylor Marks said. After the semifinal match, these guys were hardly able to walk, so hats off to Stahl for taking care of himself and being ready to play today. Defensively, Taylor Marks led the Kingsmen with 10 digs, while Logan Marks came up with 8 and Cooper 6. Hurek led the way with 3 of the Kingsmen's 8 blocks in the final match. It was an emotional meeting in the locker room, Cal Lutheran coach Kevin Judge said. I've wanted this for these guys from day one. I saw the potential in them. I just kept believing it, and I tried to get them to believe in it too. When the moment came, they shined. It was an awesome performance. The Kingsmen can now call themselves champions, the 17 strong. These past 2 weeks showed that we were 17 strong. Vaughn Ramsey and Colin Jones led Vassar with 11 kills apiece, while Jacob Kim and Gavin Okoto delivered 8 apiece. A.J. Erickson put up 22 assists, and Kim added 17. Defensively, Billy Fan led the Brewers with 11 digs, and Kim chipped in 10. Kim also had 2 of Vassar's 5 blocks. In the local and area roundup, UD 5th at ARC meet. The University of Dubuque is in 5th and Loras in 9th after the first day of the American Rivers Conference men's golf meet at Glen Oaks Country Club in Des Moines. Nebraska Wesleyan leads at 16 over par, 1 shot ahead of Luther. UD is at plus 24 and Loras at plus 46 with 2 rounds remaining. Dubuque's Matt McQuillan sits in a tie for 7th in the medalist race at plus 4, just 3 shots off the lead. In college baseball, Buena Vista 11, Loras 3 at Storm Lake. Jackson Cullen went 3-for-4, and Jake Olszewski went 2-for-3 to highlight the Duhawks' 7-hit attack in the loss. Loris fell to 22-14 and 11-9 in the ARC. And in men's college lacrosse, Dubuque 16, Cornell 6 at Oyen Field. Aiden Culligan scored 5 goals, while Sam Todd contributed 3 and Giovanni Silva 2. UD concluded the regular season at 9 wins, 6 losses overall, and 3 wins, 1 loss in the MLC. Now some sports in brief. Candace Parker announces her retirement from WNBA. 3-time WNBA champion and 2-time Olympic gold medalist Candace Parker announced Sunday she's retiring after 16 seasons. "I promised I'd never cheat the game and that I'd leave it in a better place than I came into it," Parker wrote in a social media post. "The competitor in me always wants one more, but it's time. My heart and body knew, but I needed to give my mind time to accept it." Parker played her first 13 seasons in the league with the Los Angeles Sparks, establishing her dominance early as the number one pick, who won Rookie of the Year and League MVP in the same season. Parker was the first WNBA player to accomplish that feat, averaging 18.5 points, 9.5 rebounds, and 3.4 assists, while helping the Sparks to a 10-win improvement in 2008. Parker earned her second MVP award in 2013 and won her first title in 2016 with the Sparks. She'd go on to win a second title with the Chicago Sky in 2021 and a third with the Las Vegas Aces last season. She's the only player in league history to win a championship with 3 different teams. "The memories Candace Parker created for a generation of women's basketball fans will remain ingrained in our collective conscience forever, but she has given so much more to the game beyond her accolades and statistics," the Aces said in a statement. "As a teammate and mentor, a mother and wife, a baller, broadcaster, and businesswoman, she has inspired countless young people, both boys and girls, to chase and achieve their dreams." That brings us to the end of today's reading of the Dubuque Telegraph Herald for Monday, April the 29th, 2024. I'm your reader, Scott Splavik. Thanks for sharing your time with IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind.